I was in conference with Lord High Admiral Herakal and his staff when there was a mild commotion at the barred doors of the command room.
"What is it?"
Herakal bellowed in a voice that echoed through the cavernous chambers of the Admiralty.
"I ordered no distractions."
The captain of the guard unlocked the polished cedarwood doors and came through them, bowing and blurting apologies. "Lord Torren of the Privy Council has sent a message. He says that it is of the utmost importance and must be delivered to the hand of Lord Taita, the Egyptian, without delay." Herakal cast me a lugubrious glance of disapproval and threw up his hands in mock despair.
"Let the knave in. Let them all come in. Go ahead and disobey my orders whenever you take it into your heads to do so."
Swiftly I came to my feet to protect the fellow who was quailing before Herakal's wrath. "I must accept full responsibility, Lord High Admiral. I have been expecting a dispatch of the utmost importance from my sources in Egypt."
"We will all wait on your convenience, Lord Taita."
Grumbling to himself, Herakal rose from his stool and stalked to the windows, where he stood staring out at Mount Kronos across the bay. I snatched the dispatch from the captain's trembling hand. It was a tight roll of yellow silk, no larger than the top joint of my little finger, and almost as weightless. When I unfolded it, I saw that it was as long as my arm and densely covered with the coded symbols that Aton and I had devised between us. These were a great advance on any other written language in existence, both in their compactness and in the range and exactitude of meaning that they made available to the writer. I read through the message swiftly and glanced up at the Lord High Admiral before he had time to compose and deliver his next complaint.
"Lord High Admiral, I have wonderful news. We have been presented with the opportunity of striking a blow at the heart of our mutual enemy. Gorab of the Hyksos has assembled a cavalry force of more than 1,000 chariots on the plain of Shur, on the western extreme of the Nile Delta."
"I know that area," Herakal exclaimed as he turned back from the window. His tone had changed. "It runs along the shore of the Middle Sea, between the cities of Zin and Dwara."
"That is correct," I agreed. "Over the past year, my pharaoh and Lord Kratas have concentrated their offensive on the westerly bank of the Nile. They've advanced as far north as Lake Moeris, which is only 80 leagues south of Zin." I spread the yellow silk square on the table, and Herakal and his staff gathered around it. Aton had written his message on one side, but on the reverse side he had drawn a detailed map of northern Egypt, which showed the disposition of the armies, both Hyksos and Egyptian. "My sources report that Gorab is planning a major flanking maneuver, swinging down the eastern border of Egypt to strike our extended line here at Qam." I touched the silken map. "It's a cunning plan, but his assembly area at Zin is extremely vulnerable to attack from the sea. It seems that Gorab is still ignorant of our combined fleet, now waiting at Krimad for just such an opportunity."
"You say Gorab has 1,000 chariots?" Herakal demanded.
"That means he probably has more than 3,000 charioteers. You will be heavily outnumbered. If Gorab becomes aware of your plans, you will be annihilated if you attempt to attack them."
In rebuttal, I tapped the scrap of yellow silk.
"Yes, indeed. Gorab has 1,000 chariots concentrated at Zin. But my information is that he has not yet detached his charioteers from his main force, facing Pharaoh and Lord Kratas at Lake Moeris. As it stands now, he has fewer than 500 men guarding the chariots." I read the figures from Aton's silk message. 500 men and twice as many horses." Herakal smoothed his moustaches thoughtfully.
"That is roughly equal in strength to your own force."
"My flotilla is ready for sea, and we can be off Zin in 6 days from now, before Gorab is able to bring up the rest of his men. I can beat my chariots in their rear and attack them before they know we have landed. We will have the advantage of complete surprise, which is worth 1,000 fully manned chariots."
I will tell you straight, Lord Taita, that I don't like it. It all seems too neat and fortuitous. It smells to me like a bear trap. However, the Supreme Minos has given you an independent command. You do not have to have my sanction for this harebrained scheme.
Then we have nothing further to discuss, Lord High Admiral. I thank you for your advice and good wishes, and I will take my leave.
I rode alone over the mountain, and I pushed my horses hard. I arrived at Cremad an hour before sunset, and found both Zaras and Hui at the stables. They were astonished to see me, but their surprise turned to unholy joy as I told them what I had in mind.
"Get the horses on board while it is still light," I told Hui. "Zaras, take as many men as you need and make sure the chariots on all the ships are securely lashed down before we sail."
Bellowing orders at their men, they rushed to follow my orders. I went to the coop, which was the new home of Aton's pigeons, which had survived the perilous voyage from Egypt. I selected two of the plumpest and strongest of them, and tied the identical message onto each of their legs. Then one at a time, I kissed them on the top of their heads and tossed them fluttering into the air. They circled the harbour four times to get their bearings, and then headed south-southeast and disappeared into the gathering dusk. A night run was safest for them. Hawks and falcons do not hunt during the hours of darkness, but I had repeated my message to Aton to make doubly sure. I had asked him to have guides waiting for us on the beach at Zin in 6 days' time. They were to meet us when we landed and lead us to where King Gorab had assembled his chariots. An hour before midnight, my flotilla of 6 galleys left the harbour. As soon as we had made our offing, we turned to the south in line astern, heading for Egypt and the Bay of Zin. In the darkness of pre-dawn, we missed the squadron of 12 fighting galleys led by Nakati, Prince of the Sea Peoples, in his own ship, the Dove. Nakati was hurrying to Cremad to warn me of the morass of treachery and betrayal into which I was blithely sailing with my little squadron. Nakati reached the port of Cremad a few hours after sunrise to find me and the ships vanished. However, I had left 5 of my men who, due to wounds and sickness, were unfit to sail with me. These invalids had been with me on the voyage from Sidon in Sumeria when I captured the Dove and chained Nakati to the rowing bench. They had also been present when I unchained him and reinstated him to command of the Dove. Thus, they knew he was one of us, and so they did not hesitate to tell Nakati where I was headed and the purpose of my sortie to Zin. Nakati lingered in the port of Cremad just long enough to take on water and provisions from my warehouse. Then, almost 3 hours after sunrise, he set off again with his flotilla in pursuit of mine. But I had an 8-hour head start. Of course, at this stage, I had no way of knowing that Nakati was following me at his best speed. On the contrary, I had heard nothing from him since I turned him free on trust. Now I was inclined to regret that hasty decision. I was starting to believe that he had duped me and returned to his role as Prince of the Sea Peoples, and that I would never set eyes upon him again, except over a naked blade. It was not until much later than the events I am describing here that I learned that Nakati had stood by our agreement. However, it had taken him all this time to recruit crews for his ships from amongst the ranks of the pirates and freebooters that made up the tribe of the Sea Peoples. In retrospect, I should have known better, but I had always believed the Sea Peoples to be a disorganized rabble, lacking the organization and structures of a modern navy. I had overlooked the fact that many of the pirate princes were trained and skilled fighting seamen, who only by force of circumstances had become renegades. It followed that they had at their disposal an extensive and tightly organized intelligence network that was certainly more efficient than that which my old friend Lord Aton was running. Nakati had double agents placed amongst Aton's people,
but he also had his spies in the headquarters of the Hyksos in Memphis. I do not doubt that he had even penetrated my own network. Through these sources, he was fully aware of the correspondence that Artaun and I had exchanged. He knew of my intention to raid the Hyksos chariot depot at Zin, and he knew that the Hyksos were also aware of my intentions. However, Nakati did not have pigeons to send to warn me of what was taking place. He had come in person to save me from disaster. But he had arrived too late. In the outrage, we made our landfall on the African coast in the half-light, an hour before sunrise, on the fifth day after leaving Krimad. I had navigated deliberately on a course with slightly westerly deflection. There was no navigator alive who could sail a ship for 5 days out of sight of land and arrive at a destination as precise as the Bay of Zin. To have made my landfall on the easterly side of the bay would have been dangerous. The coastline, closer to the Nile Delta, was heavily populated. We would have been spotted as soon as we showed above the horizon. If I could not be certain of sailing directly into the Bay of Zin, then it was safer to err to the west. The western shore was the Sahara proper, inhabited sparsely by a few roving Bedouin. More importantly, I was absolutely certain of my headings as soon as I sighted the land. Without hesitation, I gave the orders for all the flotilla to turn in succession to port and sail in line ahead, with the desert close on our starboard side. We sailed for 3 hours parallel to the shore before it became clear that I had overdone my deliberate error. This was of great concern to me at the time, but it proved to be fortuitous. It gave Nakati that much extra leeway to close the gap between our two squadrons. At last we came up level with the mouth of Zin Bay, which I recognized by the prominent headlands that shielded the interior from the northern approaches. I gave the order to tack in succession, and we ran in through the entrance to the bay. The Hyksos were waiting for us. They came at us in a mass as soon as we passed between the headlands of the Bay of Zin. They must have assembled everything that would float for 100 leagues along the shore and the delta of the Nile. They were too numerous to count. There were craft as small as luggers and as massive as the single trireme which led the attack on our flotilla. The closest vessels blanketed those behind them. The larger ships screened the smaller ones. But at a hasty estimate, I judged that there must be at least 25 Hyksos vessels opposing our 6. All their decks were thronged with armed men. Their helmets, cuirasses, blades and shields glittered in the blaze of the rising sun. Their war cries and challenges carried clearly across the water as they came to meet us. The early morning wind was blowing briskly from the open sea, through the entrance to the bay directly behind our squadron and into the faces of the Hyksos. This prevented me from reversing my course and attempting to escape the way I had come. On the other hand, the Hyksos ships were headed directly into the wind, as close-hauled as their hulls would allow. They were loafing along, barely maintaining steerage. Our 6 vessels were charging forward with the wind filling our sails and white water foaming under our bows. Within a dozen strokes of our oars, we were at full ramming speed. I could see that the decks of the enemy vessels were so closely packed with men that their archers were hampered by the press of bodies and shields. On the other hand, Zaras and Hui, Akimi and Dilbar, and my other captains had taken full advantage of our more sparsely manned ships. Even before we passed between the headlands of the bay and ran into the ambush, our archers had been prepared for any eventuality. Their bows were strung, and their arrows were laid on the stocks of their bows. As soon as the range between the enemy and our leading ships closed to long arrow shot, Zaras gave the order to loose. The wind coming in directly over our stern was our ally. It gave us an advantage of better than 100 yards. Our archers were able to loose 10 volleys before the Hyksos could loft their arrows high enough to reach us. The dun cloud of our arrows swept over their decks, and the slaughter was prodigious. The shrieks of the wounded were counterpointed by the thump, bump of the striking arrows. The enemy trireme was larger by almost half than any of the ships in my squadron. But in these contrary wind conditions, her bulk was much more a liability than an asset. I saw that she was paying off before the wind. The great bronze ram on her bows was no longer pointed at us menacingly. As she yawed, she was exposing her tumble-home and her midships, where her planking and her treble banks of long oars were most susceptible to our assault. "Ram her as she turns!" I snapped at Zaras, and he leapt to obey my order. Our drummers increased the beat to attack speed. The men on our rowing benches were fresh and eager. They pulled until their eyes bulged from their sockets. Before the thrust of the wind and the impetus of our oars, the Outrage hurled herself forward. I prompted Zaras to continually make fine adjustments of our helm, so that the bronze spike of our ram was always aimed at the most vulnerable point in the trireme's hull. We thrust aside the smaller Hyksos luggers and longboats that were between us and our target, and at the last moment before we struck the trireme, Zaras bellowed the order, "In oars!" Our rowers shipped their oars neatly. And with a rending crash, our bronze ram, shaped like the beaked head of an eagle, smashed through the hull of the trireme and rolled her over on her side. The screams of her men blended with the crackle of rending timbers and splintering oars. Both her masts snapped off at deck level. She rolled past the point of no return. The waters poured in through her open rowing ports. The slaves, chained to the benches, drowned almost at once, and the fighting men crowded on her top deck were poured into the sea alongside the floundering hulk. Zaras and I were thrown to the deck of the Outrage by the force of the impact. The Outrage had been stopped dead in the water, so that by the time we had hauled ourselves to our feet, the smaller Hyksos craft had been able to cluster around us and hurl grappling hooks over our sides. Their armed boarders were already scrambling furiously aboard the Outrage, howling like a pack of wolves around the carcass of a deer. They were coming over both our gunwales, swinging battle axes and thrusting with swords. We were surrounded. Zaras and I and the other deck officers formed a circle, back to back, facing outwards. We were consummate swordsmen who had fought together on numerous occasions. We outmatched the Hyksos attackers with their wild swings and crude lumbering rushes. But as fast as we cut them down, others came swarming over the sides of the Outrage to take their places. Almost at once, the deck beneath my feet was slippery with blood, and my arms were wet with gore to the elbows. But still the Hyksos barbarians came at us and died. Zaras at my right hand seemed indefatigable, but I was tiring rapidly. My arms were growing heavy, and my feet were losing their grace and agility. I killed another man, and as I kicked him off the point of my sword, I glanced over the ship's side and saw that all the other vessels of my flotilla were heavily engaged, surrounded by enemy vessels and fighting for survival. Then, to my horror, I saw that another dozen enemy vessels were entering the bay from the open sea, big fighting galleys filled with cheering men who pulled lustily at their oars. I knew that we were about to be overwhelmed by sheer weight of numbers, and we could not survive much longer. I considered for an instant how we might disengage and make a run for the open sea, but I realized that the thought was not only the last resort of the craven spirit, but it was also the fantasy of despair. There was no escape from this bloodbath. We fought on as fresh waves of enemy poured aboard us. At last, I was reeling on my feet with exhaustion. Zaras jammed his shield against mine to steady me. But by now, even to lift my sword required brutal effort. My face and arms were splattered with the blood of the men I had killed. Then another bearded enemy face appeared before me, and I hacked at it with my blunted blade. By now, the cutting edge was dulled and chipped, and the point was broken off. My blow was so sloppy and feeble that my new adversary turned it aside with a contemptuous twist of his wrist. "Taita!" he shouted at me, and I checked my next thrust and stared at him dumbfounded. For a moment I did not recognize him through his beard and the ruddy veil of spattered blood that dulled my vision. But now I realized that he was not another Hyksos brute. His features were noble and familiar. "Put up your blade, my lord. I am your liegeman." I even recognized his voice. "Nakati?" I gasped. "I thought that I had seen the last of you." "The gods are not always attentive to our pleas," he grinned as he repaid me in my own words. Then he seized my arm to prevent me falling, but I shrugged his hand away. With fresh hope came renewed strength. "You cut your arrival fine, Nakati. Nonetheless, you are welcome." I pointed over the bows of the outrage to where the surviving Hyksos had abandoned the battle. They were fleeing to the safety of the land, beaching their boats, abandoning them, and escaping into the dunes. "Catch those fine fleet-footed fellows for me. Then we can turn our attention to the destruction of their chariot depot, if we can find it." He laughed at my choice of words. "Neither fine nor fleet-footed enough. The Hyksos cavalry lines are less than a league from where we stand," he assured me. "Are you sure of that?" I demanded. "My informants are not as numerous as yours or Lord Arton's, but they are at least as efficient. They informed me of this ambush that Gorab's men had prepared for you. I sailed to Krimad to warn you, but when I arrived you had already left. I thank Horus and Isis that I was in time to find you still alive here." "I also am grateful for that." I wiped the sweat and blood from my face with the tail of my chlamys, and stooped to pick up an abandoned enemy sword from the deck to replace my own battered weapon. As I straightened up, I shouted to Zaras, "Take us into the beach! Don't let one of the Hyksos animals escape!" We ran our own ships aground on the sandy beach. In obedience to my orders, Nakati led his men in pursuit of the fugitive Hyksos, while Zaras and Hui unloaded our chariots and put the horses into the traces. The Bedouin guides that Arton had sent to meet us emerged from where they were hiding in the dunes. Hui and I mounted up, and with half our chariots, followed the guides to the Hyksos cavalry depot. Zaras joined forces with Nakati's men. In the remainder of the chariots, they set off in pursuit of the Hyksos fugitives from the battle who had escaped into the dunes. The Hyksos guards at the cavalry depot had been too far from the fighting to have been alerted by the tumult and uproar of battle. When Hui and I drove our chariots up to the periphery fence of the depot, I called on them in their own language to open the gates. They took us for reinforcements sent from their main army in the south, and they threw the gates open to welcome us. By the time they realized how mistaken they were, our men were amongst them, knocking down their weapons and forcing them to kneel with their hands behind their backs while they were trussed. In the parking ground of the depot, we found 850 newly built chariots drawn up in neat ranks four deep. Obviously, the Hyksos carpenters had copied the design of our Egyptian vehicles. These were a great improvement on the traditional Hyksos machines. The bodywork was woven from malacca cane and bamboo, much lighter and more flexible than solid pine or cedar. The wheels were spoked rather than solid, making them faster and more durable. These vehicles had been freshly lacquered, and they were so closely packed that their wheel hubs were touching. We anointed them liberally with lamp oil that I had brought with us for this purpose. When we tossed burning torches into them, the flames jumped from vehicle to vehicle, reducing them to ashes in the time it takes for a thirsty man to drink a cup of good wine. I was happy to see them burn rather than arrayed against me, for they would have made formidable adversaries. As soon as we had dealt with the Hyksos chariots, Arton's guides led us to their cavalry lines. There were almost 2,000 chargers being held in the reed-thatched stables. One thing, perhaps the only thing, I will concede to the Hyksos, is their excellence in horse handling. These animals had clearly been carefully bred and selected, then devotedly groomed and trained to burnished perfection. I love horses in preference to any other animal species, including most human beings. At the very least, you can trust a horse. We drove them down to where our ships lay on the beach of the bay. I was not certain how to dispose of them. 2,000 horses is a great multitude. We did not have room for them in our ships, even with the addition of Nakati's squadron.
When the suggestion was made by one of Nakati's officers that we slaughter these magnificent creatures rather than allow them to be recaptured by the Hyksos, I felt every nerve and sinew of my body burn with indignation. I turned on Nakati. "Are there not 50 men amongst these blackguards of yours that understand and love horses?" I demanded of him. "There are, my lord." He could see how infuriated I was. "Give them to me, Nakati. I will divide the herd between them. Then each of them should attempt independently to drive his animals south into Egyptian territory. They will choose separate routes. I will pay a bounty of a silver deben for each horse they deliver to my estate at Mekia. If any man of them dies in the attempt, I will care for his widow and children for my life, my oath on it." Within less than an hour, Nakati had assembled the volunteers. They drew lots for their share of the captured animals and then drove them out into the gathering twilight, splitting up into smaller groups as they went. Some of them had decided to drive their horses into the Sahara and try to circle to the west around the Hyksos positions to reach our very Egypt. Others were determined to cross the Nile Delta, swimming their horses through the tributaries of the great river to reach the Sinai Peninsula in the east before turning south along the shores of the Red Sea to reach Thebes. I watched them go, and said a devout and fervent prayer to Horus and Inanna, begging them to watch over my horses during the perilous journey that lay ahead of them. Now I could turn my attention to the prisoners. With the garrison of the chariot depot and the survivors of the battle in the Bay of Zin, we had captured 793 Hyksos charioteers and sailors. Zaras and Nakati had these prisoners kneeling in long lines on the beach above the high water line. They had been stripped naked, and their arms were tied behind their backs. They were resigned and morose as men waiting at the foot of the gallows for the summons from the executioner. "What should we do with these miserable creatures?" I demanded of Nakati and my officers. None of them showed much interest in the subject. "Our ships, that had been damaged in the battle, had been hastily repaired and relaunched. Those that were beyond repair had been set on fire and were burning on the sands. The battle had been fought and won. Everyone was anxious to go on board and sail away before fresh Hyksos hordes came howling over the dunes for blood and vengeance." "Kill them," suggested Hui offhandedly. "I agree," Zaras nodded. "Kill them all." He spoke in Hyksosian and loud enough for the nearest prisoners to hear and understand. "That is good advice," Nakati gave his opinion. "If we let them go, they will be back tomorrow, killing our men and raping our women." The others growled agreement, but Nakati held up his hand for their attention and went on speaking. "However, Lord Taita, I know you well enough by now to be certain that you will never agree to our very sensible suggestions. You could never kill in cold blood a man who has surrendered to you." "Perhaps you give me too much credit for chivalry," I shrugged. "I might surprise you." But of course, he knew my protestation was insincere. He grinned at me. "Let me make a suggestion," he proposed. "Let me show you how we can make certain that these swine never again shoot an arrow or wield a sword against Pharaoh and our very Egypt. Then you can release them to the dictates of your conscience, my lord." "How do you propose to achieve that? Will we ask them to give their parole and place our trust in that?" I was irritated by the futility of this debate.
I also was anxious to go on board the Outrage and head back to Crete, where my princesses were. I had already made up my mind to release the captives just as soon as we sailed. "A moment more of your attention, I beg of you," Nakati nodded to a group of his own sea people, who were standing guard over the kneeling prisoners. They dragged one of the Hyksos charioteers forward and pushed him face down on the sand, with his arms still tied behind his back. Nakati stood over him and drew his sword. "Hold up your thumbs, fellow," he ordered, and the prisoner obeyed gullibly. With a double flick of his blade, Nakati severed the thumbs from both his hands at the second joint. The prisoner screamed with pain and despair as the blood spurted from the stumps and his disjointed parts fell, twitching, into the sand. "I will wager that this man will never again wield a sword or draw a bow against Egypt," Nakati said. We gaped at him in shock and dumb amazement for a few moments before all my men let out whoops of delighted laughter. Then Zara stepped forward before I could intervene. With his foot he rolled the naked and maimed prisoner onto his back. He drew his sword and slipped the point of it under the man's flaccid penis. "And here is the way to make certain he never again rapes an Egyptian woman or one of our newborn infants." With an upward slash of the blade, he severed the member at its juncture with the prisoner's groin. Then he speared it onto the point of his sword and flipped it into the surf that lapped the beach. "An offering to Poseidon, the god of the sea, if he accepts such a foul piece of swine flesh." The men around me shouted with approbation, but my voice was louder than any of them. "Cease that brutality at once, Arras. Put up your sword. You descend to the same level as any Hyksos animal." Zaras ran his blade back into its scabbard, but when he turned to face me, his chin was up and his eyes were as fierce as mine. "My lord Taita, there is no space in our ships to take them into captivity," he defied me. "If you release these animals unharmed, how many more of our people will they slaughter? How many more of our children and women will die?" Slowly, I felt my rage wilting before his stubborn logic. I realized that my own judgment was clouded by the memory of the injuries that had been inflicted on me by the gelding knife. I was reluctant to allow those same brutalities to be visited on another human being, however evil and monstrous. I took a long deep breath to calm myself, and then I modulated my voice to exclude the anger from it. "You make good sense, Zaras. I am going to meet you halfway. We will take their thumbs, but leave their pricks for Seth to pick." I deliberately used the childish euphemism for the penis. I was attempting to de-escalate the tension that had flared between us. We and the others guffawed openly, and Dilbar grabbed at Akimi's crotch. "Ain't your prick feeling a peck peckish? You ain't seen a ripe canny since we sailed from Crimad." My men were all boys at heart. I forced myself to smile along with them. But when I turned back to Zaras, the smile dropped from my lips. Zaras was glaring at me ferociously. Gradually, silence fell over the rest of the men. The only sound was the wind and the whimpering of the wounded prisoners who lay writhing on the sand. When Zaras spoke again, his voice was cold and clear. It carried to every one of us and chilled our hearts. "My sisters were 7 and 8 years of age when the Hyksos overran our village. My father was with his regiment. The Hyksos raped my mother first and then both my sisters, taking turns with them for half a day. I was 5 years old, but I had managed to escape and hide in the fields from whence I could see everything. When they had finished with them, they threw my mother and sisters into the flames of our cottage while they were still alive and screaming." Zaras drew a long breath, and then he asked me, "What would you have me do now?" There was no answer that I could give him. I shook my head sadly and said, "Do your duty to Pharaoh and to the memory of your family." "Thank you, my lord," Zaras replied. Then he drew his sword and went back to join Nakati. Between them, they selected 30 of their best axemen to perform the amputations. Each of them was given 4 assistants to pinion the prisoners and drag them forward. The first victims clenched their fists and refused to present their thumbs for the blade. The axemen wasted no time trying to persuade them to do so. They simply lopped the entire hand off at the wrist. The prisoners that followed were more cooperative. Then the assistants rolled them on their backs, and with just a little ceremony, their genitalia was hacked away, and they were turned loose to stumble into the dunes, moaning and clutching their injuries in an attempt to staunch the bleeding. The seagulls were attracted by the smell of blood. Raucous flocks of these scavengers gathered to squawk and flap over the growing piles of thumbs and sexual organs. They gulped down these titbits almost as swiftly as the axemen could hack them loose. I was sickened by it all. I turned away and went to where our ships were drawn up on the beach. I tried to ignore the screams and supplications of the Hyksos captives. Instead, I concentrated on supervising the loading of our chariots and horses, together with the amphorae of water and provisions that we had found in the cavalry depot. When he had finished the bloody work on the beach, Nakati came to take his leave of me. In accordance with our agreement, he intended to continue wreaking havoc on the Hyksos ports and towns along the shores of the Middle Sea. When at last Zaras clambered on board the deck of the outrage, he came to me immediately and went down on one knee before me. "I disobeyed you, my lord," he confessed. "I defied your orders in front of the men. You would be fully justified if you reduced me to the ranks and dismissed me from your command." "You did what you knew was right," I replied. "No man can ever do better than that. Take command of the ship and set sail for Krimat." He rose to his feet. "Thank you, Taita. I will never disappoint you again." As the sun sagged wearily to the western horizon, I climbed to the masthead of the outrage, from where I made one last survey of the sea behind us, to be absolutely certain that there was no sign of pursuit by a Hyksos squadron. All was clear. The north coast of Egypt was merely a thin strip of the blue above the darker blue of the sea. Our flotilla was closed up with stern lanterns, lit to enable our navigators to maintain their precise stations in the formation through the hours of darkness. The leadsman in the bows called, "No bottom with this line." We were in deep water and on course for Crete. I was in my preferred position at the masthead. I heard Zaras dismiss the watch below. The rowers shipped their oars and curled up on the deck to sleep. The wind was fresh on our quarter, and all our sails were spread. Suddenly, I was weary to the very depths of my body and soul. The fighting had been grueling, and my confrontation with Zaras even more so. I considered descending the mast and retiring to my narrow bunk in the stern cabin. But the following breeze was warm and still redolent of the odours of my beloved Egypt. The gentle oscillation of the mainmast lulled me. My body ached dully with the bruises and nicks that I had received in the Battle of Zin Bay. My cabin seemed far away. I made certain that the line around my waist was secured to the mast, against which my back was pressed, before I closed my eyes and let my chin sag onto my chest. When I woke again, the moon had reached its zenith, and its reflection on the surface of the sea was keeping pace with us, casting a pathway of glittering silver over the wavelets. The smell of Africa had been replaced by the salty tingle of the ocean. The only sounds were the susurration of the water under our hull,
the regular creaking of the mast in its boot, and the whisper of the wind in our rigging. My aches had dissipated and my weariness with them. I felt vigorous and alert once more. I was filled with that strange sense of elation which I had come to recognize as a sure sign that the goddess Inanna was close. I looked for her eagerly, and felt no surprise when I saw her gliding along the pathway of the moonlight to meet our ship. The hood of her mantle was thrown back, and the moonlight played on her face. She was lovely past imagining. When she came abreast of the outrage, she stepped from the surface of the sea onto our deck and looked up at me. Her expression changed, and so did my mood. I was suddenly filled with a sense of dread and foreboding. I knew that Inanna had not come to commend me for my victory on the plains of Zin. She did not speak, but nonetheless I heard her voice echoing softly in my head. "The god is angry. Cronos demands the ultimate sacrifice. I do not understand." I tried to speak, but the words stuck in my throat. "Go to them. They are in mortal danger." Her voice was silent, but I heard the warning clearly above the sound of the wind and water. I tried to stir myself to go down to her, but I was unable to move. I wanted her to explain her enigmatic message, but I could not speak. Then the dark shadows of sleep fell over me like a net, and she was gone. I struggled to retain my senses. I tried to cry out in the darkness, "Don't go, Inanna! Wait for me! I don't understand!" But the darkness overwhelmed me. I don't know how long I slept the second time, but when I did manage to struggle back out of the darkness, the dawn was breaking and the black-winged gulls were dipping and diving across our wake. I looked down, and the deck below me was bustling with activity. The first watch of oarsmen were filing down the companionway to take their turns on the rowing benches. I untied the rope that secured me to the mast and slid down the backstay to the upper deck. As my feet hit the boards, Zaras hurried to meet me. He was smiling and shaking his head. "My lord, you didn't sleep in the rigging again, did you? Does your bunk no longer please you?" Then he saw my expression and his own smile faded. "What is it?" "Jettison all our chariots immediately," I ordered. "Transfer all our horses to the other ships of the squadron." He gawked at me. "Why, Taita?" "Do not question my orders. I don't have time to argue with you again." I was so impatient that I seized his shoulder and shook it. "Take a full team of oarsmen from every one of the other ships. I want to be able to change rowers every hour." "Every hour?" Zaras blurted. "I want attack speed all the way to Krimad." "Attack speed?" He looked incredulously at me. "Don't keep repeating everything I say, Seth, damn you, Zaras," I growled at him. "I want to be in Krimad 5 days from now, or even sooner, if possible." "You will kill my men," he protested. "Better they die, rather than the royal princesses." He stared at me, aghast. "I don't understand." "Both the princesses are in mortal danger. We may already be too late, but every hour we lose is an hour closer to their certain deaths." He spun away from me, shouting to the watch officer, "Fly the signal for all captains!" The other ships came alongside us two at a time, one on our port and one on our starboard side. Each of them put 20 of their best oarsmen on board the Outrage, with water and rations for 5 days. In exchange, we gave them the slaves and weaklings from amongst our own crew. We transferred all our horses across to them, hoisting them on the loading pulleys and swinging them across the gap between our vessels. We used the same equipment to lift our chariots and jettison them overboard. I wanted the Outrage to be floating high and light. Even 5 days to Crete was a tall order. When it was the turn of Hui's vessel to come alongside, Zaras took him aside and spoke quietly to him,
but I read their lips. We turned away from him and came striding down the deck to me with a determined expression on his face. "Very well, Hui," I forestalled his argument. "Put a good man in command of your ship and come over to us. But be warned, you will take your turn on the rowing bench." As soon as we had our full complement on board and the first team of rowers in their places on the benches, the drummer gave them the beat. He built up gradually from steering speed to attack speed at 10 strokes to the minute. The outrage took wing, and we flew through the water. Within the first hour, we had left the rest of the flotilla below the horizon behind us. When I changed teams, the men who were relieved fell off their benches, lathered with sweat and choking for breath. Day and night, over the next 3 days, our speed never bled off. Zaras and Hui took their shifts on the benches, and even I rowed a full hour in every 12. When men half my age faltered, I never missed a beat. The memory of Inanna's unspoken warning sustained me. "Go to them. They are in mortal danger." It was the afternoon of the fourth day. I had just relinquished my place on the rowing bench, and, still dripping sweat and panting, I went to the ship's bows to scan the sea ahead. I had no way of calculating how far we had still to go before we raised the island. I was not even certain that we were still on course. I had placed my faith in Inanna to guide me. However, the sea ahead of us was still empty, and the horizon was slick and unbroken. There was no wind. The sky was cloudless, burnished bright and merciless as the blade of an executioner's axe. The air was heavy and oppressive. It had a faint but unpleasantly sulphurous taste that seared the back of my throat. I coughed and spat over the side, and then I looked back over the stern. The only movement was the undulation of our wake and the stippled whirlpools left by our oar blades on the polished surface as they rose and fell. I was about to turn away and go below to try to get a little rest, for I had slept hardly at all since leaving the Bay of Zin. But just then, something on the horizon ahead caught my eye. It was a thin, undulating, dark line. I stood and watched it for a while, until I realized it was a flock of birds flying directly towards us. I am very fond of all the avian species, but I could not recognize these until they came much closer. Then I was astonished to see that they were common crows. The Cretan crow is usually a solitary bird, or paired with a mate. Furthermore, crows always stay close to land. It was for all these reasons that I had not identified them from a distance. This was a flock of several hundred of these birds, and they were at least 100 leagues, or probably much more, from the nearest land. I watched them pass overhead. They were cawing to each other with an urgency that sounded to me like a distress call, or at least a warning cry. When they were gone, I looked again to the north, and I saw more birds in flight approaching. Some of these were also crows, but there were many other species as well, ibis and herons, kestrels and eagles, and other raptors passed over us. Then came the smaller birds, robins and larks, sparrows and doves and shrikes. The sky was filled with birds. Their numbers almost darkened the sun. Their cries were a strident cacophony that was almost deafening. There was a sense of desperation in this feathered exodus. A tiny yellow canary dropped from the sky and landed on my shoulder. It was clearly exhausted. Its whole body was trembling, and it piped pathetically when I took it in my hand and stroked its head. I looked up again in wonder, and still the flocks passed over us in their multitudes. We and Zaras came and stood with me, both with their heads thrown back and their faces turned upwards. "What is happening, Taita?" we demanded. "It seems to be a mass migration, but I've never seen anything quite like it before." "It looks more as though they are fleeing from some deadly threat," we suggested. "Wild animals, and especially birds have an instinct for danger," Zaras agreed, and then looked at me for confirmation. "Is that not so, my lord?" I ignored the question, not because I did not know the answer, but rather because at that moment there was a splash alongside the bows of our ship, which was made by some heavy body. I looked over the side, and the surface of the sea was boiling with life. Great shimmering bodies were tearing under our hull. Another mighty shoal of tuna was following the same direction as the flocks of birds that filled the sky above us. I looked ahead and saw that this shoal stretched out to the northern horizon. Their silver shapes streamed past us endlessly. And then there were other creatures mingled with them. Glossy black porpoises ripped through the surface with their dagger-sharp dorsal fins, throwing up rooster tails of spray behind them. Whales, which were almost as long as our ship, blew clouds of steam through the vents atop their heads as they surfaced to breathe. Sharks, striped like tigers and with evilly grinning mouths lined with jagged teeth, dashed past us, heading southwards. It seemed that all of creation was in panicked flight from some terrible cataclysm taking place beyond the northern horizon. As the hours passed, so this great agglomeration of flying and swimming creatures gradually thinned out until there were no more of them. We were alone in a deserted world. We few mortals and the tiny yellow canary which had stayed with me, sitting on my shoulder and trilling sweetly in my ear.